Hello, welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here for a special episode. We've got a guest that we're looking forward to interviewing. But before we get to him, let me just introduce myself. I'm C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've written a number of books. One of those books is In the House of Tom Bombadil. I've taught philosophy. I've been a commercial real estate investor and yada, yada, yada. That's enough about me. How about you, Tom?
Tom Price. I teach systematic theology, Christian ethics, philosophy, apologetics, and one of the places is Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
One of our members, or one of the pugs in the pugcast, can't be with us today. That's Glenn. Glenn had a health emergency in the family. Glenn and his wife, Lynn, are fine. And we'll probably be able to fill you in when we know a little more. But it's someone close enough to Glenn and Lynn that they really need to be there by his side at this time. But we'll let you know. Just keep them in prayer and that situation in prayer. And we'll fill you in the details, as I said. But we've got a guest today, an author, someone that we're looking forward to hearing from. This is Michael. Michael, why don't you introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about your background and so forth. We've got a very diverse audience in terms of the range of people who listen to the show. So go ahead and just fill us in on whatever you think is relevant for us to know, particularly as it relates to the subject of the book.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the elevator pitch for me, I guess, is I'm a contributing editor at the American Conservative. I'm an editor at Sophia Institute Press, which is a Catholic publisher. I was the editor of Crisis Magazine. Before that, I worked as the U.S. editor of the Catholic Herald, which is a London-based Catholic magazine. And most of my work right now goes to my Substack, which is called The Common Man. And I'm working on a new book called The Times Are Wretched, which comes from a sermon from St. Augustine. It's going to be published by Sophia Institute Press. But my first book, which was published a couple years ago, is called The Reactionary Mind. And I believe that that's what principally interests you about me right now.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Mike, it's I think it's good for us to tell people, you know, your full name. It's Michael Warren Davis. Your name on the screen is just Mike Davis. But if they type in Mike Davis looking for your book, they might not find it. So just so they know that it's under your full name. And but that's the title of the book, The Reactionary Mind. It's got a derby and a mustache, and that's going to sort of create and a monocle.
That's right, yeah.
So I think the combination of those elements will appeal to many people who listen to our show. But the subtitle of the book, which is fun to consider, is Why Conservative Is Not Enough. So let's get into that, because you work with this. You draw a definition or present a definition of the reactionary and use it, and you contrast it with the conservative. So can you kind of spell that out a little bit? Because I think for some of our listeners, they might not get the distinction just without an explanation.
Of course, yeah. So, I mean, I think that for as long as I've been a journalist or reading the media, following the media, reading books about political philosophy or whatever, and probably for considerably longer as well, the consensus, I think, is more or less been that the conservative movement is useless. It doesn't do anything. It seems like the more invested we become in conservative politics, the more money we give to conservative politicians, the more conservative magazines proliferate, the more we lose, the more setbacks we suffer, the more hostile what the West becomes to people of traditional Christian sensibilities. And I think that's because there's a flaw at the foundations of what it means to be a conservative. But that we can probably get into that if you want to. But basically, the reason the conservative isn't enough is because there's nothing left to conserve in the West. Everything that we know and we love and that we cherish and that forms good Christian men, good Christian values, is gone. That's why I say that we have to, and that's why the conservative movement keeps failing, and it's why I say that we have to be reactionaries, because it's not enough to try to preserve what we have now. We have to go back and reclaim what we've lost.
Now, a lot of people use reactionary in a pejorative sense, obviously people on the left, and you're not you know, using it in that way. So spell out what you mean by reactionary.
I like that it's pejorative. That's part of why I
it's sort of like saying Yankee or something.
Right. Like that. Depends on where you're from. Yeah. I like that reactionary is a pejorative because it sort of takes the wind out of the left sails. Because you say my book, The Reactionary Mind, is to give the really offensive version, which is also, I mean, accurate. You know, it's about why it's good to burn heretics. It's about why it's good to burn nude art. They say that sounds totally reactionary. You say, yeah, that's the title of the book. What else do you got? Where am I wrong? Where's the lie? So I think that that's so important because so much of the reason that conservative politics fails and so much of the reason that we're losing is because we're so not – us personally, but our leaders are so susceptible to tone policing. It's so easy to bully them into being nice and PC. And that's what it gives me the willies, but you just gotta get in front of that. You gotta stop it before it even starts. You have to get right out in front of it and say, no, you're not gonna call me names. You're not going to browbeat me. I'm not going to be, you know, the nice controlled opposition. I'm a reactionary. And if you want to tell me I'm wrong, do you have to actually tell me why I'm wrong? You can't just tell me that I'm mean.
Yeah, that's right. That's great. You know, in our circles, we refer to what you're getting at here with this sort of niceness as either third wayism or winsomeness, and so in the Reformed world, we have plenty of people who are, I guess, the Reformed version of the U.S. Council of Catholic Bishops. You know, if you know what I'm getting at. It's just that kind of like we just want to make sure that everybody when they think of us think about the things that bring, you know, smiles to everyone's face and never offend anybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are some great chapter titles in this book. The introduction is entitled The Happy Warrior. That was great. Then the first part of the book is more or less, I would say, you know, an attempt to sort of recover the past. Yeah. And so, chapter one, The Reactionary's Dreams of Heaven. Two, The Reactionary's Code, Loyal and Joyful. Three, Why the Reactionary Has a Sneaking Suspicion for Savonarola, which is a fun one. We ought to get into that one a little bit.
Yeah.
Reactionaries Defend the Inquisition. That's another one that we got to get into a bit. Why Reactionaries Don't Follow the Science. That's timely. Why Reactionaries Don't Worship Reason. That one we can dig into a bit. I think that's an interesting one. Why a Reactionary Would Like to Abolish Politics. So, you know, in other words, a reactionary is not like living on cable television news and like thinking about the latest whatever is being voted on in the House every single moment of the day. Reactionary Working Man, Paging Ned Ludd. I think we're talking about the Luddites here. The Reactionary American, which is an interesting title because some people on the left claim that America is essentially liberal, so it'd be good to get into that. Then Against Progress. So there's a that's just part one. Part two is also got some great things, but maybe we'll have some time to get to part two in a minute. But let's get into some of these. Let's Savonarola. You know, Tom and I were talking about a little bit about him. I think what if you could sum up, Mike, what the popular impression of Savonarola is. And then give us your reason why we should say some other things about him.
Yeah, sure. That's my ecumenical chapter because the best Catholics and the best Protestants all like Savonarola. The popular impression, obviously, is I strongly suspect that most people sort of 40 and under who have even heard of Savonarola know him from one of the Assassin's Creed games, where he's this squeaky voiced, cowardly fanatic who uses alien technology to control everyone's minds. And it's just amazing how people can take this, you know, this heroic figure and reduce him to, but in a way it's instructive because that is the only way that a modern person can rationalize who Savonarola is, right? Because the truth, which is that he never held public office because he maintained his power from the pulpit. I mean, he never had any authority over anyone. It was just that he spoke and people listened and did what he said because they knew that he was good and wise. That blows people's minds. It's a category error. But so the popular impression of Savonarola is of this religious fanatic who for a couple of years ruled Florence with an iron fist, what everyone knows, right, is the bonfire of the vanities. He would allegedly send his teenage boys into people's houses to take all of their art, all of it, and all of their books except maybe the Bible. And all of their, you know, lavacious clothing, and then put them in this big piles in the streets and set them on fire. that is sincerely what probably 99% of people who have heard of Savonarola, which is a very small minority, but of the people who have heard of Savonarola, that's what they think he is.
So what was he? So you describe a different man, in your chapter. Can you dig into that a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. The Savonarola, very early on in his life, felt a call to be a preacher. He had visions, literal visions of plagues and of catastrophes being visited on the part of Italy where he lived around Florence. And he was born to a very good the Savonarola family. His grandfather was the court physician to one of the local princes. So he came from a very, very good family. He was expected to follow his grandfather in his footsteps and become the court physician for this illustrious noble family. But he felt this irresistible call to become a preacher, to warn people, to be a prophet, to warn people that that terrible things were going to happen to Italy unless the people repented and tried to follow God. So he becomes a Dominican. He ends up becoming a Dominican friar, develops a reputation quite early on as a preacher, and is actually invited to Florence by the Medici family. They give him control of the. The friary is at San Marco, I think. And so he establishes himself there. But of course, who better exemplifies the kind of the decadence and the corruption that Savonarola feared than the Medici? So he becomes this. He becomes this thorn in the Medici side. And so there's this, they can't get rid of him because they don't technically own the monastery, right? It's the church. So he's preaching to people about how these tyrants who are exploiting the poor and the Medici have to reform their ways, and you know the rich have to stop exploiting and abusing the poor and this and that. And he's really preaching about the dangers of the excesses of the Renaissance, the dangers of the excesses of humanism. So he becomes this kind of strikingly countercultural figure. What's fascinating is that when Lorenzo de' Medici is on his deathbed, he has, you know, unfortunately, usually Franciscans who are, sort of his court priests. And he's surrounded by these priests that he's been keeping as house pets. But he knows that he's at the end of his life. And so he says, bring me Savonarola. And they say, no, you know, Your Excellency, it's not, you know, you don't want to talk to him. And they say, and he says, you know, I'm surrounded by sycophants. None of you care about my soul. You only care about my money. I want to talk to Savonarola. And so Savonarola, they bring him in, and And Lorenzo says, you know, Friar, what do I have to do to go to heaven? And Savonarola says, do you want to know? Do you really want to know? And he says, yes. He says, you have to give back all the money that you took from the poor. You have to give back all the wealth that you took by exploiting the children of God. And Lorenzo refuses. And Savonarola says, then I will not give you absolution. And he leaves. And Lorenzo dies, you know, and as Catholics would say, does not die in a state of grace.
So what's interesting about that, Mike, is that, you know, as you noted, people associate Savonarola with a kind of puritanical approach to the arts, with the bonfire of the vanities and so forth. But what you're showing us is that what was, you know, really offensive to the Medici was his, you know, calling them to repent over their exploitation of people who were vulnerable economically in Florence, which is sort of odd. You would think that would make him a hero to, you know, people on the left who are looking for people like that. Mm. Lorenzo is surrounded by Franciscans, you said, which is another kind of interesting thing. who would have been considered the advocates of, you know, voluntary poverty and all that.
Right. Yeah. You can bribe just about anyone. I will say, I do personally, you know, much prefer the Franciscan in the Franciscan spiritual tradition. But the other thing that I like to remind people is that the Franciscans actually contributed more inquisitors than the Dominicans. History is never what you expect. But for Savonarola, the economic and the sort of the moral abuses and decadence went hand in hand, which of course is true. And I will get to the part that I think everyone wants to hear, which is about the bonfires.
Let me, before you jump in, tell you just a humorous aside, but it's related. I remember during my student years at Duke Chapel, which happens to have right above the chapel doors several saint figures. One of those figures, before I get to one of the figures, the dean of the chapel was giving a sermon to us students upon entering, and he was talking about one day he saw in his audience a guy in a white outfit who looked very familiar. And when he was at the end of the service, it was Tom Wolfe. And Tom Wolfe asked Will Willeman, he was the chaplain at the time, he said, who is that one figure that's standing above us, that statue? I recognize the other. And he goes, oh, that's Savonarola. And Tom Wolfe's response was, only the church would pull a stunt like that. And then he walked off. And when you're talking about Bonfire of the Vanities and Duke Chapel, which is right in the heart of big tobacco money and all this arrogance and prestige with these degrees, watching over every student who enters and exits that chapel door upon graduation, there is Savonarola.
I have to admit, when you said the white suit, I thought you were going to say it was Savonarola in his Dominican.
he had a vision of Savonarola in it.
You know, St. Philip Neri had a vision of Savonarola, and with the Savonarola was going up, was his the Vatican was posthumously just determining whether to have him basically stricken from the record to permanently anathematized. And St. Philip Neri went in. They went to St. Philip Neri, and they said, you know, will you pray and tell us, you know, if everything's going to go well, the Dominicans did. And so St. Philip said yes, and he went away, and he came back, and he said everything will be fine. And so the Vatican court rehabilitated Savonarola after having martyred him.
So tell us about the Bonfire of the Vanities. Go into that a little bit more if you want to, or you'd like to.
Absolutely. So there's this whole really cool story about the French invading Italy and Savonarola getting them to leave Florence alone. It's probably too long for right now. But But basically what happens is Savonarola saves the city from being plundered by the French. The Medici flee. They actually side with the French. And then the people, they don't put him, it would be wrong to say that they put him in power because, again, he never even holds a symbolic office. He's just the, he's a prophet, right? He's, he rules the city as a prophet. He's a moral leader, enacting incredible political reforms, banning usury, founding, credit unions that give low interest loans to the poor to help try to level the economic system, creates a new, more, he leads the drafting of a new constitution that leads to more democratic institutions in the city to prevent the return of oligarchy. And, so all good things, but again, through the whole time, he's really a symbolic leader. He's just a friar that everyone knows and respects, and they believe what he says, so they do it. And so before Ash Wednesday, before the beginning of Lent one year, he says to the people, instead of having your Mardi Gras celebrations, instead of having Carnival, right? Instead of spending the days before Lent sinning more, right? And really going against the letter of and the spirit of Christianity, why don't you actually prepare yourself for Lent? And he said one way to do that is to there are so many women in indecent clothes all over the city that there are so many filthy pornographic books and paintings in the city, and I apologize, it gets a little bit graphic, but there is a specific genre of painting at that time that is explicitly pornographic, that was painted and bought by wealthy Italians to hang in their bedrooms to act the same way that Playboy acts, right, in later days. Right, so this is explicitly and intentionally pornographic art. He said, bring out these pornographic books, bring out these pornographic paintings, bring out your lewd clothing, he said, and destroy them so that, you're not in this habit of, sinning, you're virtuous for Lent, sin, and then you go back to sinning, right? He says, make permanent reforms in your life. And this is what the bonfire, the vanities are. They're totally voluntary. No one was ever forced to give up any of their possessions. And B, they were, it's absolutely untrue that, all art that depicts nude figures was destroyed. It was, Savonarola approved of nudity in art. He believed that there was a way to do it tastefully, which is why among his strongest supporters in the city were Michelangelo and Botticelli. Some of the greatest artists, the greatest artists of the Renaissance were huge admirers of Savonarola, because not only was he a great moral leader, but, it's the beauty of holiness. He recognized that art that is fundamentally indecent can't truly be beautiful. He said that if you take two women who are equally beautiful, let's say twins, right? Beautiful twins. And you have one of them dressed decently and one of them dressed indecently. Of course, the one that's dressed decently is going to be more beautiful. Everyone knows this. Everyone knows this from experience. And he said, this is what artists in the Renaissance needed to hear. They needed to hear that, nudity itself was not inherently, was not going to make their artwork more beautiful, that there was a way to depict the human body modest and doing so modestly that would actually accentuate the beauty of the human form.
The aesthetic dimension you just mentioned, the deep commitment to beauty and holiness, which was very characteristic of a very rich classic Christian theology, had wrapped in it, from what I'm understanding here, a sort of moral, a proper moral disgust towards things, artwork or things claiming to be artwork, that miss the measure and miss, you know, and so another way of putting it is there was a spiritual moral offense at something missing the high mark of aesthetic, you know, sort of moral aesthetic or spiritual aesthetic. And this, I think, is something clearly that contrasts with anything in a lot of the contemporary imagination who just sees art almost always in crass, functionalist, and disconnected from any kind of transcendence. And so I think, you know, I mean, the only thing close we can maybe get to it is some of the parents now who are finding their children in public schools having pornographic literature and the outrage that they see all the while leaders and conservative leaders saying nothing, you know? So, I mean, that's about the only comparison I think that I can think of in the moment that is matching anything with a semblance of what you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. That kind of that moral outrage. I think the Eastern Church understands this a little better than we do. But the unity of truth and beauty, the beauty is really the first form of evangelization. It is the way that Christ is beautiful, and that's how the story of Christ is beautiful. Yeah. And this is how we first understand the truth is that you read the Word of God, or you hear the story of our Lord spoken, or you see His face, and you say, yeah, there's something here, absolutely. And then you need to, you go deeper and you learn the substance of it. But you know, beauty is truth, and truth is beauty. And
that's one of the things that I think, when we think about von Balthasar, and his work on beauty. I think so within the Reformed tradition, the accent is on truth. In other words, it's almost abstracted from goodness and beauty. In other words, you can actually hear almost an approach that seems sort of relegates even moral goodness as well as beauty to sort of the sideline. And the only thing that you need to think about is whether or not this particular proposition is true, you know, that kind of thing. But your point, I think, is right. I think it goes right to the heart of, you know, what we actually kind of know from evangelism and how evangelism achieved or how it sort of proceeds, and that is a. You know, when we think about the life of our Lord, what we see is His goodness, the man who went about doing good. And we also see the beauty of that life in His moral, character, but also in terms of His sacrifice. Didn't von Balthasar say something like, I knew the Nazis were wrong because they were so ugly? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But... yeah, so like when I look at the first half of the book here, the part one, what I'm seeing you do, and this is a fun thing to think about, is you're basically addressing the libel of the dead. We've talked a little bit about this in the show, that essentially what we do is we pat ourselves on the back by making our ancestors look bad, doing the best we can to bring out all the things that were wrong about the past and just ignoring all the stuff that was good. And you've reversed that in the first part of the book, helping us see, you know, there really were a lot of things about being a serf that were great. For example, <Yeah. laughs> so absolutely. Let's get into that. You know, when we think about serfdom, you know, when we think of, the path to serfdom, you know, that classic kind of libertarian economics, Austrian economics book, you know, the implication is the last thing you want to be is a serf. But you make the case for serfdom, is that being a serf wasn't so bad. Well, so what was it about being a serf that was actually pretty good?
Well, the funny thing is that pretty much everything that that Western man wants now, and that is considered that everything that we work for, everything that's when you say, "Oh man, I've got this, I've made it," the serfs kind of had built in. It's hilarious how much of like conspicuous bourgeois consumerism. You just serfs had, I mean, it was a given. And
like organic food?
I don't think so. Right. Lots of chemicals. There's no way to do it, right? So this was every tomato, every was 100% what is it, BP free or whatever. And but I mean, you know, the smallest plot of land that a serf would have had was about 1 acre. And you know, here in southern New Hampshire, if you have an acre of land, you've made it big, really big, right?
Yeah.
All of their settlements were walkable. Because
another cool thing that the Bobos love, you know, you got to have that walkable community.
Absolutely.
The bourgeois Bohemians. You remember that book,
David Brooks.
Yeah, Bobos in Paradise.
That's right. That's right. They were talking about the Middle Ages. That's what. Don't tell David Brooks though. Yeah, and also, I mean, there some studies have estimated that serfs had almost half of the days of the year off from between, obviously, religious festivals, but some of those festivals and wedding feasts and baptism feasts, some of them would last a week or more, right?
Yeah.
And in that period of time, the Lord would give his serfs the time off. So, you know, lots of – and then, you know, unpolluted air. none of this really intrusive noise that you get everywhere in the world today, whether it's airplanes, cars – piped music and restaurants and things like that. It's just quiet.
Muzak.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, one of the things, you know, one way that I think we can make the case for serfs is Hobbiton. Yeah. So, like, when we see, you know, the opening scenes, you know, I'm not a Peter Jackson fan, but maybe most people, you know, only know as much about Tolkien as Peter Jackson was willing to kind of give them. But when I do think that his portrayal of Hobbiton is fun and is true to the book. And I think many people are entranced and taken by it and are wistful for it. Maybe the reasons why they might feel impatient with it have to do with kind of some of the effects of the modern world and how it's sort of disrupted the ability that we have to enjoy peace, quiet, good food, company, that kind of stuff. Because there's always a sense that we have that we're missing out on something because we don't have our smartphone with us or whatever.
That's right. Mostly what you're missing out is bad news, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard it referred to as doom scrolling.
Exactly. And the funny thing is, I don't know if you've noticed this, but every year around Easter, you get this wash of articles by people who say, you know, I went off Twitter, for Lent, and it was the best time of my life. And I was so much more engaged with people. I slept better. And then, you know, at the bottom it says, you know, follow him on Twitter, and he's right back to it. Right? It's like Easter Day. This is how you celebrate Easter, is by logging back onto Twitter.
Right. Yeah.
And it's – so there's – obviously these technologies are highly addictive and very, very evil, and they do no good, but they do lots of harm. But the good news is that at least for now, people know that it's not what they really want, or it's not what's really good for them. They do it compulsively. Oftentimes they do it because if you're a journalist now, I mean, I don't have a Twitter. I don't know any other journalists, you know, who are working in my who don't have a Twitter. It's almost – and it's professional suicide. I mean, I'm not trying to martyr myself, but it's
no,
tough.
No. Yeah, and, so Tom and I are old enough to remember a world that was even pre-internet, and it's almost impossible to sort of like recover, you know, the kind of a surprise. Like when the internet became a thing, it's almost as though I was like in 19, whatever it was when the Model T came out. And I had only seen horses my entire life, and there's this Model T coming into town, chugging and puffing away, and cranky, you know, making cranky sounds. And initially, I was incredulous. I was like, "This will never catch on. This is all these people saying that it's going to do this." And I was like, "Yeah, right." So I'm actually kind of a nut, a Luddite, to a degree. I'm not a Luddite in practice because of what you just brought out. It's pretty much impossible to function in our society today without a smartphone. Just think about that. 2008 was when the iPhone was introduced. And today it's like, I get friend requests from like the poorest parts of the world, some guy in an iPhone.
Yeah, money for his ministry.
I was like, if you had just turned on that iPhone, maybe you'd be able to pay for the bills for like a half a year. But anyway, I guess the thing that you're doing though is you're helping us, I think, enter imaginatively into a space where we're able to say, it really was better when there wasn't light pollution. You could look up in the sky at night, and if there weren't clouds and haze, then you might actually see the Milky Way. I mean, how many people have actually seen the Milky Way with the naked eye? I've seen it twice in my life.
Yeah, and it is funny because from a greeny perspective, which the left prides themselves on being, how many of them realize that the engine of modernity, which is, whatever you want to call it, industrialism, consumer capitalism, this is what's destroying the earth. Right. And it's not only, and I talk about this a little bit later in the book, but it's not only that it's destroying the earth in an abstract sense and that, it's causing global warming and it threatens the human population. It threatens the species. That's all probably true. But it also, on an individual level, it makes it hard for us to enjoy nature. It makes it hard for us to enjoy God's creation. And in a way, this is silencing God's voice. This is one of the ways that God makes Himself real to us. So the attack on creation is an attack on God. I didn't mean to go down that rabbit hole, but
no, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right on. I actually gave a little part one of a paper last night locally at the new Blake Center, which is very nice place. You're in New Hampshire, so it's not too far from you, I guess, a few hours.
So it's connected. It's connected with Hillsdale. It's Hillsdale's new Connecticut location.
Faith and Freedom.
Oh, wow. Okay.
One of my fellow parishioners is kind of directing over there, so he was kind enough to host. But one of the things I was talking about is kind of the retrieval work in theology that has been going on that all Christians committed to classic Christian confession have been about retrieving kind of classical understanding of what we go by the metaphysics of creation and just how full and rich it is, the analogous character or the gift character of everything. And one of the questions that came up is, well, what does that look like when we start to actually take it seriously? And I was kind of comparing it to the kind of the world that came, after people started to reject that classic vision, one in which they're, like you were talking about, the Renaissance with the development of a notion of the humane, but basically centering on the radically isolated individual, disconnected from anything else other than what serves his own glory. How highly isolated and disconnected that vision, basically promoted in where we ended up. And I was just talking about exactly that point, the way, contrast that with all of creation being theophanic, being that which in its own way, because of the distinct form and purposes that it has, manifests the invisible attributes of God in a visible way. And as we see it in the light of Christ, we are able to, of course, see it with a clearer lens and enjoy something of the gift that it is, and something of God in relation to it. So it opens up a whole different view of your relation, not just to each other, but to the whole of creation than the kind of cheap substitute that the modern world picked up and ran with. And so I think what your book highlights and what you're talking about now really is something of that richness, a connectedness to the gift character of everything as it's related to God, that is fundamentally missing in our our contemporary alternatives.
Yeah, I think, too, getting to the subject of evangelism again, are you familiar with Paul Kingsnorth?
Yeah.
So here's a guy who is about as far to the left on the green agenda as you could possibly be. He's come around the other side of the world, and now he's a Christian. And I think some of us in the conservative world, because we're so sort of freaked out by the Gia worshipers, we lose sight of the fact that interest in the creation and a desire to enjoy it is a means by which God speaks to us. And when it comes to Kingsnorth, you know, basically Kingsnorth is disillusioned with the green agenda now because it's been co-opted by basically the corporations, the megacorp, you know, scene. You're in New Hampshire, Tom is in Connecticut. We all know what Vermont is about. I've thought about what, you know, the thing about Vermont and New Hampshire. I mean, anybody who knows anything about New Hampshire knows you guys are the libertarian, you know, sort of place. And then anybody knows anything about Vermont knows it's kind of the burning socialist kind of green place. It's almost as though that it represents the fissure that's occurred that Tom was just talking about, you know, this inability to sort of see all this together. So if you could have a kind of libertarian sort of pro like enterprise green agenda without it being, it would kind of look like the Shire. One of the best things about Vermont is that there are no billboards there. I mean, you go into the place and billboards are illegal and Walmart's virtually illegal, and it's actually kind of cool.
Yeah. I love Vermont. And the one thing, everything that you said is true, but it is funny that Vermont's one of those places that's just where people are so cut off from me. It's so remote that they have really no idea what the implications of their leftward drift are for the most part. Obviously the people in Burlington do, but you've got, yeah. I mean, the people who voted Bernie Sanders into office, the ordinary people that live out in rural Vermont, they're all armed to the teeth. Okay. You know, they realize that the Democratic Party wants to take their guns. They don't see any contradiction between socialized medicine and the Second Amendment. And I guess in theory there isn't one, except if you're,
Have you ever seen the Green Mountain Boys machine gun shoot? It's hilarious. It's on, if you go onto YouTube and just type in the Green Mountain Boys machine gun shoot, it's like the premier machine gun shoot on the East Coast. It's just awesome.
We'll check it out. That's great. I will see if I can go in there. It's on invitation. That's really cool.
Yeah. So is there anything else maybe in this first part of the book you'd like to get to that we haven't had a chance to talk about? I mean, there are a lot of great things here.
Not necessarily if anything piques your interest, I'd be happy to.
Well, I think why reactionaries don't worship reason. So that would be kind of an interesting one. Why don't you kind of unpack that a little bit? Why don't reactionaries worship reason?
Yeah, that's I think we actually – the best answer may or may not be the answer that I gave in the book, because I've been thinking a lot about this recently. We already touched on it. Is this idea that beauty is in itself a truth? It's a way of perceiving truth, and for most of the time, it's like our fundamental way of perceiving truth. Right? It's the way that we first begin to recognize what truth is, and very often, you know, these the most important truths of our lives are not things that can be accessible equally to every dispassionate intellect, right? But that is the Enlightenment project, and that's basically the whole project of modernity, is that if you can't sit down across from me and make and argue me into the position that you hold, it's not worth anything. So Pope Benedict said something to the effect of, it's only through, prayer is faith in action. And it is only by practicing the faith that we begin to see the evidence for God's experience. So that is true. And that is at its best, that's what tradition is this assurance that, you know, that older and wiser people have over generations that says, you know, you young man, you, the God might not make sense to you. The idea of God might not make sense to you. You might not understand what the benefits of fasting and prayer and penance are because you've never really done them. But you have to trust us who have done it, who know it, that it's worth doing. And I'm not saying that you have to do it and then just, you will see the benefits. You just have to, you have to try first. You have to practice that. And then, but that, that kind of, that, you know, this tradition, this received wisdom, that we can test and prove for ourselves through practice. That tradition is totally, we'll just call that tradition. That is totally contrary to the principles of the Enlightenment and all thought that's followed the Enlightenment, which is that truth has to be readily accessible to my, you know, my five senses and the, you know, the most basic kind of human logic. You have to be able to write it down on a napkin and explain it and make it compelling, or it doesn't exist. It's not true. Exactly. And, you know, and that, so that is the probably too convoluted explanation as to why reactionaries don't worship reason.
Yeah, I think that most people intuitively agree with you. I think most people would say, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But then they maybe object to the notion that tradition, as, you know, the practice of handing down, you know, handing over, is going to always be, I guess, trustworthy. In other words, I think a lot of folks will say, well, you know, you remember Fiddler on the Roof, and, you know, you got Tevye and he's talking about their traditions, you know, tradition. It's great. I think it's a lot of fun, but I actually think that that film is a vindication of tradition, or that musical is vindication of tradition, because at the end you see sort of the debris that modernity, has produced. But I think that he's asked at one point, you know, why does your apron have tassels? And he says, I don't know. and that's what kind of what you're getting at, is the idea that if you can't explain it, it's worthless. When maybe the more reasonable, and this is the fun thing to kind of like blow my people's minds, but maybe the more reasonable option is, well, just because you don't know is not proof that there's no reason. It's just that maybe it means that you're stupid.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what frightens people about tradition. I mean, it is the idea that someone else knows better than they do. Mm-hmm. And not only knows better than they do, but can know better than, is better at knowing than they are. That we're not all equal in that sense, that there are some people who are wiser and more experienced. Oh, the Psalms say something about that. I am wiser than the aged because I keep thy law. That's absolutely true. You can, a young holy man is clearly wiser than, I'm trying to think of someone like Noam Chomsky or Gore Vidal. Right?
they're posers.
Put him next to you know, Saint Francis of Assisi when he's 23 and you know, throwing off his robe and kissing the leper and trying to rebuild. I mean, who, even on the left, who wouldn't say that's wisdom?
So the other half of the book, though, is addressing the situation that we find, and we've been doing some of that as we've talked. So the first half of the book is an attempt to recover the wisdom of the past. Things weren't as bad as you were told. Everybody in the Middle Ages didn't believe in the flat earth. A lot of them knew the earth was round. You know, that kind of stuff. And then the second part is, this is now, and you're, you know, looking at a sense, in a sense, things aren't as good as we think. So the past wasn't as bad as you thought. The present is not as good as you think. So you've got chapter 11, among the champagne socialists, I think I know who you're talking about. You used to call them limousine liberals. the humane economy, the view from Nazareth, that's chapter 12. All News is Fake News. Now, that's a fascinating title. I agree with you, and I'd like to maybe get into that one a little bit. Towards a More Blissful Ignorance. We got to talk about that one. Technoholics Anonymous. We've already touched on it a little bit. The Patient Arts. I think that's good. Musings of a Human Liberationist. Yeah, that's good. The Strenuous Life, bringing in Teddy Roosevelt there. Anyway, and then the conclusion, The Coming Dark Age, which I think you probably are going somewhere that maybe, you know, different authors in the past have gone, kind of like, you know, Rod Dreher and so forth.
Yeah.
But I guess when we look at this, I'd like to talk about the chapter 13, you know, title, All News is Fake News. What do you mean by that?
Modern news, news as we know it now, really comes of age, or is the modern kind of way of doing media, is really invented by William F. Buckley, who is in many ways admirable, but in many ways not so much. He was the real pioneer of newstainment, of the idea that, you know, the news should be done in a way that's entertaining so that it becomes a marketable product. And so he wouldn't have envisioned it going nearly as far as it does now, but when you treat news as a product to be sold, then obviously it changes the way that news is reported. Opinion obviously is a lot more popular than facts, right? Because everyone has an opinion, they like to hear their own opinions echoed back at them, and they also like to get angry reading the opinions of people that they disagree with. So this idea that it has to be that news has to be something that's eye catching, that you can use to sell ads or subscriptions. This changes the way that we do media, and so we see the fallout from that everywhere now today, where whether it people journalists who don't wait to break stories, who just run with it. Any gossip, any rumor that they hear, the way that even straight reporting has been infected by opinion, that there's not even an attempt to make, you know, an objective analysis or an objective report on what's going on.
Yeah. I think, you know, as I think about this, you know, I, grew up in a world of, you know, Walter Cronkite, you know, Brinkley, and I can't remember his partner's name, but there was at least the aspiration, right, to tell it like it was.
Yeah.
Now, if you analyzed the presentation closely, you could more or less discern where the person's convictions were. but at least there was this idea that, okay, you know, like Cronkite always signed up, and that's the way it was, you know.
Yeah.
Now, does anybody do that anymore? I don't know. I mean, today, you know, you've got entire news networks that don't even pretend, don't even aspire. It seems like, you know, maybe Fox News with regard to its way it pitches itself,
right?
You know, but I guess, you know, that brings up the kind of the tension that we see between, or the tug of war, I think we see between truth and profit, or truth and interest, expressed economically, and how that undermines both the quality of reporting and the livability of our world. You know, when we think about, say, what happened with the COVID thing, you know, I think we all suspected all along that there were some vested interests. And those vested interests were not hard to discern, but nobody in the media was interested, or in the mainstream media was interested.
No one wanted to touch it.
Yeah, no one wanted to go there. And why was that? Well, it doesn't, again, take much imagination to see that there was a connection between self-interest, income for the networks, sponsorship, that kind of stuff. So I think that's all. I'd like to dig into a little bit deeper your take on William F. Buckley, though. you know, in terms of, so when you, like, you know, Buckley is somebody that, you know, Tom and I remember, and obviously you remember. I don't know how many people still have an image of Buckley in them, but I, you know, it's firing line, you know, firing lines is that he's leaning back like, and making making
four or five new words every show. That's right.
So yeah, he, in fact, I remember he had a calendar that was like the word of the day calendar. But anyway, kind of let's dig into that a little more. So what was it about Buckley's approach that, you know, you're bringing to the surface here that undermines what we should be looking for in news? You mentioned, you know, entertainment, but how did he do it?
Well, there's two real ways, and I'm going to try to remember both of them as I explain. And by the way, for anyone that's listening, I don't want to sound like I'm impugning Buckley. I think there is some truth to what I say. Well, you'd hope so, but it's just to say you can't say it makes no sense to say this is my opinion. It may be wrong. If you think it may be wrong, it's not your opinion. So one of the things that Buckley does is he gives the impression that, because he and his guests are so intelligent, he gives the impression that after 1 hour of discussion, of conversation, you've really boiled things down to their fundamentals, right? You've really got to the heart of the matter. And so it becomes the the emphasis becomes not on and this is news, right? It becomes not who is the more informed, who's more, even more intelligent. It's who is a better rhetorician.
So
rhetoric has its place. What's that?
The triumph of rhetoric over truth.
Absolutely. Yeah. And rhetoric has its place, as we all know. But it is dangerous when people are getting their information from a rhetorician. That's a different function. I'm going to blank on the second thing.
Well, I mean, I think there was a recent documentary about him and Gore Vidal and their debates. And so Buckley, of course, was pretty heavy hitter and an intellectual. And of course, Vidal was equally impressive and intimidating. And you had these two guys who just hated each other's guts. And it was just like watching, you know, Ali Frazier, you know, intellectual Ali Frazier. And we don't have anything like that today. I mean, is there anything even remotely close to that kind of intellectual, ability to sort of interact and do so spontaneously? And is there anything like that on television right now? It was entertaining. Did we actually learn anything through that? Well, we learned that they didn't like each other.
Right. Oh, yeah. Well, and that's the funny thing, isn't it? Because I'm sure that there, if you wanted to, I'm sure you could find people that could do what Buckley and Vidal did. Mm-hmm. But who would watch it? Who would want to see it? And I think that that's the main problem that we're pointing out, isn't it? Is that once you start pandering to the lowest common denominator, there's no end to it. Yeah. But Buckley couldn't get a job, you know, today.
Yeah. So it started something that has taken us to where we are now.
Yeah, because it becomes labeling now. I mean, you think of the kind of – look at the way, for example, you'll have, say, a Fox News with a Tucker Carlson do a show and then watch another network who competes with it have like a Joy Reid on MSNBC and just unloads about everything racial and white supremacist about the other show's interpretation. And while they flip the back and forth, so it has really become a name-calling, ad hominem abusive – you know, kind of sport. And it really is disgusting. And like you said, if people just feed, off of that kind of sport, they're doing damage to themselves. And I know there is a damage done to the culture that only has that kind of option.
Right.
Yeah, so we're getting close to kind of wrapping up here, but I'd like to touch on at least briefly the 16th and 18th chapter. So you have the patient arts and then the strenuous life. So when you say the patient arts, what are those arts? What constitutes patient arts?
So the patient arts is really, I think for me, it's one of the more important chapters because let me zoom back a little bit. So one of the things that I always try whenever I write something is to make it applicable, to try to give people something that they can, if you agree with me, here's what I think you can do about it. And so that's the second half of the book is really, I tried very hard to say, you know, this is what we used to have. That's the first half that we talk about the history. The second half, I really tried to make about, you know, this is what, if this alarms you, if you agree, if you want to get this stuff back, this is what you can do. Yeah. And the patient arts was the last chapter that I wrote because it was just the stuff I didn't have. I couldn't fit anywhere else. Because these are the things that the patient arts is really just the word that I gave to the things that I do that help me to stay sane in the modern world to try to cultivate some truth and some goodness and some beauty in my everyday life. It's the really particularly the things that, you know, we want to change the world. We want to fix society. We want to build community, but the patient arts are the things that you can do, that you and I can do, you know, on our own all day, just day after day, to just make our lives a little better and a little more reactionary.
So name two or three. What are two or three things that we can do on a daily basis that will get us further along in that journey to that reactionary life or sort of express a reactionary way of thinking?
Yeah. So one of them, and it's maybe a little surprising. One of them is making tea the right way.
Oh, the right way.
Yeah. Right. Well, this is, I mean, in most cultures, in most Asian cultures where obviously tea is indigenous, this is a hugely important part of the day. And there's a reason for it, because making tea correctly, I mean, making a good cup of tea is an art that takes a lot of practice, that takes a lot of concentration. And it is an amazing ritual. I mean, even if you don't do a full Japanese tea ceremony. Boiling water, taking it off at the right moment, getting it down to the correct temperature, finding the best kind of tea. And good tea is not that expensive. I mean, finding the right kind of tea, finding how long exactly to brew it for, brewing it in a pot, a proper pot, as opposed to microwaving a mug, right? it's just the art of making a cup of tea is just this thing that, you know, it requires this kind of small genius. It's a creative act, and it's a very, very simple one that you can do several times a day. But it's like smoking a cigarette. It's like taking a smoke break, right? To just do this thing that requires your full concentration, and then at the end of it is kind of a thing of beauty.
What I've heard you describe there is there's a tradition of tea making.
Yeah,
but it's not an arbitrary tradition that actually is grounded in reality. The things that you do in according to the tradition actually do contribute to a better cup of tea.
Yeah.
And so you
and
have
the
to,
enjoyment of it at the end, right?
Exactly.
Right. So you have to conform to this, slow down because you can't rush it. Mm-hmm. All of these different things. That's good stuff.
It just brings delight to you, you know.
Yeah.
And that's that's something that we don't have. We don't have delight in things well done.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
It is a small thing, but it is, it becomes kind of addictive when you say, hey, I did a good job, even if it's a very, very small thing.
Yeah.
I'll do two more real quick. Another one is letter writing. Cause I think that anyone who actually has used a pen or a pencil in the last 10 years, except to make a grocery list, right? Even that, you probably use your phone now.
Right.
When you write a letter, letter writing is a totally unique form of communication.
Yeah.
And I think that if anyone who's written a letter knows that, not just in the sense that the use of paper and ink is so satisfying. It's a full aesthetic experience.
Right. Yeah.
The way that you write is fundamentally different than the way a journalist writes an article, the way that you write an email, the way you text, the way you talk. You become, I don't know what it is, but if you, when you write a letter, you become more conscious of the need for beauty in communication than in any other, I believe, I mean, having written books, having written poems, written articles, you never want to write more beautifully. You never have a greater appreciation for the beauty of language than when you sit down to write a letter. And also, it's just one of these things that it feels good and it makes people happy to get a letter, right? Yeah. It shows that you've spent this, that you've really had this one-sided conversation with some, you've given someone this all this time. Yeah. And it's just this one small thing that I think that it really impoverished us to lose this habit of letter writing.
Well, I'll never forget as a kid in school, this is long before we had the computers and all of this, that one of the things that, I mean, just open your world is if you could get the girl you like to actually give you a handwritten letter. You would walk around with that thing and treasure it. You can't do that with it. You know, what are you going to walk around with a text now and say, look, you know? I mean, it was a whole different thing. And maybe that's a kind of cheap example of it. But I still think even that, this is something someone took the time and had to reach a certain level of boldness to have a social interaction. And they put something of themselves in a tangible form and it was passed on. And there's a preciousness to it that even all these years later, it has impacted and affected me.
Yeah, I think about just how great C.S. Lewis or Tolkien were with the correspondence. They just put me to shame. You know, I'll say to myself when I get something that I know I need to respond to, man, I don't have time for this. You know, I've given all of my literary, you know, sort of energy to writing 5 pages this morning. I get a pass. But these guys, you know, they're writing books and doing things and then writing, you know, multiple, you know, many pages through correspondence to one person. That's the thing about it. Like if I say to myself, well, you know, if I get published in World Magazine, I mean, that's, you know, 10,000 people. I've that's worth the effort. One person? Unless somebody collects them and puts them into some book that gets published someday as a but how many letters did those guys write that were never discovered?
Yeah. I think about I was going to say, we don't have any great writers anymore. We have us, right? We're great writers. But I mean, the fact that, I have a copy of yours, Jack, the collection of C.S. Lewis's letters that I love. And that's a genre that will never that may never exist again.
Yeah.
The collection of authors' letters.
Yeah. Another thing is handwriting. I've noticed just the deterioration of handwriting. My kids actually admire my handwriting, and I consider my handwriting very mediocre. I look at the handwriting of my mother or my grandmother. I've got letters that I inherited from them, and I'm just astonished at just how fluid and beautiful the handwriting is. You know, sometimes, you know, for example, here's my Quaco pen, you know, I use for much of my writing, but if you tried to read my stuff, you would never know what I would, you know, it's like scratch.
Yeah, I do. And I have, I don't do it. I'm not as good with articles, but my books so far, I mean, my 1.5 book, I do write by hand.
It's
legal pads and pencils, but
I do the same too. The first run is by hand. Then I move it over.
I can't do it any other way because I don't know. It's just, you need that slow, deliberate.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And Lewis talks about this too. He talked about how, cause he used a nub pen. He would dip it in inkwell. And he said that taking the nub and dipping it in the ink every couple of, you know, every 3 letters gave him a chance to pause and think. Because, I mean, I can type faster than I can think. I'm sure that, you know, that's true. Right. You guys do. If I don't write by hand, I'd end up spending way more time than I would otherwise. I'm constantly deleting and going back.
Well, anyway, this is probably a good place to wrap things up.
Sure.
So, Mike, how can people follow you? I mean, is there a place, well, you mentioned your Substack. Is there anything else that maybe people can look up to connect with you? And
I'm happy to say that there is none. No. My Substack is, if you go on, it's called The Common Man. I think it's commonman.substack.com. And or if you just Google Michael Warren Davis, The Common Man, it'll come up. It should be pretty easy to find The Reactionary Mind from there. I hope and I pray that my next book is even better. And if anyone's interested in reading that, then that information will come through the Substack too.
So. Yeah. What are you working on? What's the next book?
It's called The Times Are Wretched. And it comes from a homily from St. Augustine, homily 311, I think, where he says, you all say that the times are bad, the times are wretched. But if you change yourselves, you'll change the times. Mm. And so it's about taking how we can take personal responsibility, what we can do to try to rebuild the church, to try to rebuild Christian civilization, not just voting even harder for the next Republican candidate, not just reading more news, sending more tweets, but tangible steps that we can take to try to rebuild the church, rebuild Christendom. So.
Yeah, well, we've talked about Francis. You know, it was bad when he was on the scene, and then Augustine, it was bad when he was on the scene. Has it ever been good? Well, for the serfs.
That's right. Just the dark ages.
this is not the first time the world has ended. So anyway, thanks a lot for listening to the Theology Podcast. We really do encourage you to check out Michael's work. We'll have a link to his Substack in the show notes. We'll also have a link to his book, The Reactionary Mind, published by Regnery. And we'll have maybe a link to Amazon, maybe even a link to Regnery for that. We do appreciate, too, that you got to the end of another show. If this is a habit that you have of listening all the way to the end, we have a number of people who support us in different ways through our Patreon account, through the Fight, Laugh, Feast Network, and we appreciate everything that people do to help make the show possible. The gifts that people give actually do pay the bills. There are bills that we incur in producing the content. Tom and I and Glenn don't take any money, but that doesn't mean that somebody doesn't get paid. There are people who need to get paid in order for this show to exist. And so thank you for your contributions. Anyway, we'll be in touch next week, hopefully. Bye-bye.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you enjoy the Theology Pugcast, you might enjoy one of our other podcasts, Got a Minute, featuring Larson Hicks and Pastor Rich Lusk. Rich theological discussion guaranteed to leave you edified.